The 2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 316, Under the Banner of Heaven, a panel featuring C. Jess Grosbeck, Ann Wild, Jana Balk-Remy, and Nadine Hansen.
Good morning. Carol reminds me that I should remind you to fill out your surveys and pass them in so that Sunstone can know a little bit more about how better to plan future symposia. My name's Robert Reese, and I am pleased to be able to chair this added panel on John Krakauer's book, Under the Banner of Heaven. We have only an hour, and this would probably be best suited for a three-hour symposium session, so we ought to get started right away. In the interest of time, I'm simply going to briefly introduce these panelists. Jess Grosbeck is a well-known Mormon psychiatrist and has the distinction of having been one of the expert witnesses at the Lafferty, one of the Lafferty trials, and will be probably addressing some of the elements of that trial. Ann Wild is a fundamentalist Mormon who is the co-author of Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. Jana Balk-Remy is book review editor of Orientum, the Latter-day Saint or Mormon literary journal. Is that the best way to say it? And is a student in history at UC Irvine. Nadine Hansen is a seminary chartered attorney and the mother of four children.
And I think I left my talk in the car, so I'm going to make
this. Okay.
So don't make me first.
Okay. Let me give a brief introduction. John Krakauer's book, Under the Banner of Heaven, is number one on the New York Times bestseller list this week. It's received a tremendous amount of publicity in major newspapers, radio, and TV coverage. Generally considered controversial both inside and outside the Mormon community. It's provoked a number of responses, some positive and some negative. One church response considered it a full frontal assault on the veracity of the Mormon church. Others have taken perhaps less extreme views of the book. The New York Times, an article on the publication of the book, said that Krakauer has begun his own culture war. Krakauer has been both praised and condemned for taking on such a controversial subject, one far afield from his earlier books. As an official church response, Richard Turley, in a piece published on the website of the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research, challenges the book on a number of points, for its anti-religious bias, for stating untruths as fact, for presenting historical unknowns as fact, for not supporting his main hypothesis, for not supporting the patterns of religious violence, and is a general negative review of the book. Questions that we might address is, to what extent is Krakauer's portrait of fundamentalist Mormons fair and accurate? We have fundamentalist Mormon who will address that, I hope. To what extent is Krakauer's portrayal of the Mormon past fair and accurate? That is, one of the questions that some people might have is, anyone who comes into a community from outside has a certain amount of freedom, and it seems to be certain advantages, but there are also certain disadvantages. You could always tell the outside people who came to BYU, they would refer to David McKay instead of David O. McKay. If they left out the initial, you knew they were an outsider. So Krakauer refers to Brody's book as magnificent, a masterpiece, and to what extent is his adopting her as one of his main sources a positive or a negative aspect of his book? To what extent does Krakauer's connection of the Lafferty brothers' quote-unquote revelations with each Latter-day Saint's right to receive personal revelation legitimate? In his book, Krakauer states, quote, as a means of motivating people to be cruel and inhumane, as a means of incitement, there may be no as a means of inciting evil, there may be no more potent force than religion. Extremism seems especially prevalent among those inclined by temperament or upbringing toward religious pursuits. So one might ask, to what extent is this fair, especially if one considers such people as Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, Idi Amin, Saddam Hussein, and other non-religious tyrants. To what extent does Krakauer, one of the questions I would ask, to what extent does Krakauer adopt the same kinds of historical methods that of his model, Brody? And what do Krakauer's revelations about himself in the books afterward, do they reinforce or undermine his central thesis? I'm going to ask Jana, who is a book review editor, to be our first panelist, and then we'll have Nadine, and then Anne, and finally Jess, and hopefully there'll be some time for some questions.
Good morning. Just to indulge my curiosity a little bit, how many of you have read a review of this book? I think there's most everyone. How many of you have read the book? All right, so a lot. Great. I've been walking around Salt Lake the past week or so with this book under my arm, sort of thinking about this panel and what I wanted to say. I'm not a native of Salt Lake, so I've been doing some touristy things, and as I've walked around the city, it's been amazing to me how many people have stopped me and talked to me, wanted to talk about this book, asking me questions like, what do you think of it? Are you LDS? Are you offended? You know, what's your take on this book? So, glad to have this opportunity this morning to talk about it with all of you. Again, this book is huge. There's so many issues that it raises, and I'm just going to hit a few that I think are interesting. First of all, in response to the question, is this a good book? I would say, yeah, in some ways it is a really good book. It's John Krakauer has a way of making things digestible and easy to read. He's a solid writer. He's able to tell this story of Mormonism, which is a huge story, from its founding of with Joseph Smith to modern-day current events, the Elizabeth Smart kidnapping, in a way that an average reader can understand in less than 350 pages. And I would say that he raises some very important issues, and I'm going to talk about those more at the end of my presentation. But at the same time, I'm going to qualify that this is a good book by saying that it has some major faults, which, in my opinion, will prevent it from having any long-term impact on Mormon scholarship. The first fault is that, as I said before, he tells this story of Mormonism in such a few pages. He has to pick and choose what to portray. Let me know if this gets better. Invariably, he's choosing the events that show Mormonism as absurd, as dark, as violent. For example, he shows, or in addition to the accounts of the Lafferty family, which are the backbone of this narrative, he tells the stories of Mark Hoffman, the Gilmores, Brian David Mitchell, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, Blood Atonement, Joseph Smith's treasure hunting, the child abuse, welfare dependence, and bloody rivalries of fundamentalist Mormons. This focus on the dark underbelly of Mormonism is interesting, but does not, as Krakauer admits in his final chapter, ring true with the lifestyle of the typical Latter-day Saint. I believe that readers of this book will see Krakauer's selective history as just that, as a means for supporting his thesis rather than as a true measure of the church. Second, in retelling the story of Mormon history, he doesn't provide any new scholarship. He's merely retelling and rehashing that done by previous historians such as Fawn Brody, Todd Compton, and D. Michael Quinn, without even giving the reader the benefit of any footnote references within the text. Third, he does a grave disservice in this book to the Mormon fundamentalist community. They're portrayed as incestuous, backwards, abusing, and cruel people. The women are described as chattel and the men as pedophiles. Fourth, Krakauer's assertions, still not loud enough. Is there any way to, do I yell? Okay, I'll lean into it. Is this better? Okay. Krakauer's assertions that Mormonism is an inherently violent religion don't hold water because he never gives evidence that Mormons are any more violent than in any other cross-section of the population, religious or otherwise. He says in his introduction that, quote, "When the subject of religiously inspired bloodshed comes up, many Americans think of Islamic fundamentalism, but men have been committing heinous acts in the name of God ever since mankind began believing in deities, and extremists exist within all religions. Plenty of these religious extremists have been homegrown, corn-fed Americans." Then Krakauer provides the example of Dan Lafferty and continues, "It is the purpose of this book to cast some light on Lafferty and his ilk, for what it may tell us about the roots of brutality, but even more for what might be learned about the nature of faith. It is Krakauer's thesis that faith and violence are necessarily intertwined that is most problematic with this book. It would seem to me that if it was truly his intention to show this, that Krakauer would have looked to sociological studies or statistics as proof of his assertion, rather than interviewing convicted murderers and disenchanted fundamentalists. However, while I see Under the Banner of Heaven as having serious problems, I think that Krakauer raises some very salient issues. Issues which, as I've discussed them with LDS family and friends, have convinced me that they're worthy of reflection. For example, faithful Mormons who accept the Book of Mormon to be the Word of God must liken the situation of Nephi and his killing of Laban to themselves. They must ask the very hard question, if the Lord commanded me to kill, would I do it? Or where would I draw the line at following the promptings of the Spirit? I asked these very questions of some at a family reunion last week. I found faithful saints who said that, yes, killing was at times necessary to accomplish the purposes of the Lord, and that they would kill if called upon to do so. This gave me a chill at my spine as I recalled Dan Lafferty's words about the murders of his sister-in-law and his niece. Quote, "At times I have started to wonder if maybe what I did was a terrible mistake. I've looked back and asked myself, what would I have done differently? Did I feel God's hand guiding me? And then I remember very clearly, yes, I was guided by the hand of God, so I know I did the right thing." End quote. Some of my family members said in response to my question that they would follow the Lord's promptings until it violated the freedom of someone else. They would draw the line at doing something that would hurt another person. While I understand this line of reasoning and respect the idea of tempering one's inspiration with a logical line of consequence, I found myself wondering where that line really was. How about on issues such as the California Prop 22 Defense of Marriage Act? Which side of the line was that on? How about on political issues such as the war with Iraq? How about on the misogyny and of mainstream Mormonism? Isn't that an issue that continues to harm the sisters of our church? Krakauer points out at the close of his book that members of the church, according to Harvard historian Harold Bloom, will soon become such a large percentage of the American population that governing the United States, quote, will be impossible without Mormon cooperation, end quote. He tells Bloom's assertion that Mormons not too far out into the 21st century will have enough political and financial power to sanction polygamy again. Krakauer admits the unlikelihood that polygamy will be reinstated by the LDS Church. However, members of the church who feel politically estranged from mainstream Mormonism must consider this question. What will happen as the church moves into the 21st century and gains more political influence on American culture? In summary, I don't believe that Krakauer's book will leave a lasting mark on Mormon scholarship. However, I would encourage Mormons to read this book and in the process to examine their own faith and its impact on the lives of others. Thank you.
Before I get into my prepared remarks, I think I'm going to take issue with just a couple of points made here. There were comments that the book unfairly characterized Mormonism or polygamy or Mormon history by its selective use of history and incidents. And my feeling is that this was not a book about mainstream Mormonism. This was not a book even about mainstream polygamists. It was a book about the very warped delusions, not even delusions, the very warped ideas of two men who committed a very vile murder. It explores some of these other questions, but I don't think that Krakauer had a duty to present the whole of Mormon history, and I don't think that his selective, what's been called his selective use of Mormon history, was unwarranted, because he was pointing out that the aspects of Mormon history and fundamentalist practice and history that particularly dealt with these murders. So I'll just say that as a preface to my remarks. If John Krakauer, if John Krakauer needs evidence that belief in blood atonement is still alive and well in 2003 in Utah, he might wish to look no farther than the following letter to the editor of the Church on Deseret News, which appeared this week on Monday, August 11th. Utah is discussing getting rid of the firing squad because some are embarrassed by its use. I oppose that change. Joseph Smith and other LDS leaders have taught that forms of execution that spill the blood of murderers helps them to atone for what they have done. Murderers need to be punished, but they should also be allowed to choose an option that allows for the most atonement. For those who profess to believe in Joseph Smith, please consider this. For those who don't, please respect our beliefs and continue to allow this option. My review of Under the Banner of Heaven has two parts. First, my nitpicking, and second, my critique of some central ideas in the book and things that I wish he'd done differently. A New York Times review recently opined that the story doesn't really hang together as a narrative. I think there's some merit to this criticism. The organization of the book jumps around from the murders to the origin of Mormonism to the abuse of women and children in polygamous societies, in the closed polygamous societies in Colorado City, Hilldale, and Bountiful. And he doesn't talk about abuse in for instance, the more like independent polygamists, such as I think Anne's going to talk about. I'm going to be interested in hearing her comments. And then back to the murders and back to Mormon history. I would read an intriguing chapter and expect to continue the train of thought, only to find that the next chapter completely changed the subject. I think I would have prepared more continuity from chapter to chapter. After tantalizing the reader in the prologue with a summary and news accounts of the Lafferty murders, Krakauer steps back and examines some aspects of Mormon history. I started being suspicious that Krakauer was not very careful in dealing with mainstream Mormonism early in the book, when he unquestionably accepted the Church's assertions that it is the fastest growing faith in the Western Hemisphere. A little research on the growth of other religions, such as Pentecostalism, Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, or a visit to the internet site Cumorah.com, would have given him a more accurate view about how LDS growth stacks up against the growth of other religions. As I read the church history parts, I found myself a little annoyed at little mistakes that should have been corrected before publication, as well as what seemed to me to be biased language and over-reliance on Fawn Brodie's biography of Joseph Smith. For instance, in telling the story of Mormon beginnings, Krakauer completely omits mention of the first vision, concentrating instead on Joseph's visits from Moroni and his involvement with magical practices. In describing Joseph's involvement with magic, he repeatedly uses the loaded term black magic instead of the more neutral term folk magic. He calls Brodie's book her magnificent, contentious biography of Joseph Smith. Contentious, yes. Groundbreaking, yes. But magnificent? I thought that was a bit of a stretch. Krakauer uses the coming forth of the Book of Mormon to describe Mormon beliefs in continuing revelation. He writes, "The imparting of heavenly truth that began with the Book of Mormon but by no means did it end there. Although it is a small point, any Mormon child could have told Krakauer that imparting of heavenly truth began with the first vision." These are small annoyances, and others were pointed out by Richard Turley in his review that's on the internet at LDS.org. And while they're not central to Krakauer's message in the book, they tended to undermine his credibility for me right at the beginning. If an author makes mistakes or shows bias in areas that I know about, I find myself wondering just how careful she or he has been in areas that I don't know much about. Some aspects of Mormon history, such as polygamy, violence, and blood atonement, were crucial to the telling of Lafferty's story. And I have little sympathy for mainstream Mormons whining about Krakauer's telling about blood atonement and the Mountain Meadows Massacre. It is not anti-Mormon to explain the Mormon roots of Lafferty's violence, even if most Mormons in the 19th century and today are, quote, peace-loving people who wish to practice our religion in a spirit of nonviolence, that's quoting Richard Turley, allowing others the same privilege. The simple, if uncomfortable, fact is that there was violence in early Mormonism, and a church that set the stage for the wholesale murder of 120 men, women, and children with teachings about blood atonement and an oath of vengeance can hardly claim to be a bastion of pacifism. Krakauer does not paint all Mormons with the brush of violence, but candor would compel us to wear shoes that fit, and whether we like it or not, this one does. I was aghast by more in the book than the Lafferty murders. Krakauer's interviews with former FLDS members in Colorado City disclose the evil and sickness in those communities that force young girls in their mid-teens or even younger into marriages with older men. While many polygamists live happy and spiritually rewarding lives, this kind of abuse also exists in those communities. And not only is it tolerated in those communities whose members have to know about it when young girls become pregnant, it is promoted and perpetrated by the pillars of the community. Just day before yesterday, the chief of police in Colorado City was convicted of having sex with a minor 10 years younger than him. And this just demonstrates that they know what's going on, and they do nothing to stop it. It's the leaders of the churches there who at times assign these girls to marry older men, and they sometimes do it forcibly and with violence. The interviews in the book with women who have been forced into these marriages as young girls are just, they were very eye-opening to me. I've always been inclined to let polygamists just leave them alone, but we cannot condone that kind of practice. And I know that Anne and the kinds of polygamous groups that she is affiliated with would not condone it either. The book's recounting of the actual murders is horrifying and chilling. Dan Lafferty's description of how he carried out the killings mandated by his brother's revelation is depraved and diabolical. After knocking Brenda Lafferty unconscious and tying a cord around her neck, Dan Lafferty describes how he was led by the spirit to baby Erica's room because he didn't know the layout of the house. He found her room behind the first door he opened, told her, "I'm not sure what this is all about, but apparently it's God's will that you leave this world. Perhaps we can talk about it later." Then he calmly slit her throat, nearly severing her head. A few minutes later, he murdered Brenda. It is pretty clear from the book that there was more going on in the Lafferty brothers' lives than their conversion to polygamy and awareness of 19th century Mormon violence and blood atonement. The father was an extremist himself, with a violent streak in his own right. He held extreme right-wing political views. He distrusted conventional medicine and refused treatment for his own diabetes, a refusal which cost him his life. He beat his wife and children, and he clubbed the family dog to death in front of his children. I think it is safe to say this was a dysfunctional family. Nevertheless, he and his wife were deemed worthy to be called abroad on a mission, though the mission was cut short when son Dan Lafferty, one of the murderers, refused to pay taxes on the parents' home and nearly lost it to the tax collector. There are way too many bizarre aspects to the Lafferty murders to recount here in this brief review. All of the Lafferty brothers, not just the two who committed the terrible murders, were drawn into Mormon fundamentalism. Ron Lafferty, who had the revelation that Brenda and Erica needed to be removed, showed the revelation to his brothers, including Brenda's husband, the baby's father. Later, Ron and Dan sat in their mother Claudine's house discussing the pending murders, with Claudine sitting nearby. Yet neither Brenda's husband, Alan, nor Claudine reported the brothers' intent to the police or warned Brenda. I felt a couple of aspects of the book needed more fleshing out. For instance, Krakauer allows Brenda's sister to ask the question of what kind of a woman could sit and hear her sons discussing the murder of her daughter-in-law and granddaughter and do nothing. Later at the trial, Claudine is called a witness where she reportedly, quote, broke down and cried on the stand, then blatantly perjured herself by professing to be unaware that Ron and Dan had talked openly in her presence about the killings. This left me wondering whether she really lied or whether perhaps she was hard of hearing or inattentive or watching television as the brothers talked about the killings. There was no answer provided. There was no further discussion of Claudine. A couple of other questions I had were, what happened to Alan Lafferty, the husband of the murdered woman? His failure to warn his wife about his brother's murderous revelation or to tell the police were inexplicable to me. I would like to have known more about whether he was called as a witness at the trial and what happened to him afterward. Did he continue in his fundamentalist beliefs? Did he leave Mormonism? Did he remarry? What was his subsequent relationship with his mother and his brothers? Those questions were not addressed. At the time of the murders, Ron and Dan Lafferty had hooked up with two men, drifters, Chip Carnes and Richard Knapp, who accompanied them to the house of Brenda Lafferty, and my time's almost up. So they were ultimately captured, and they agreed to cooperate with the police, who promised them a good deal, but it never told what happened to them, and I wanted to know whether they were prosecuted, what kind of sentence they served. Under the Banner of Heaven is a chilling, horrifying book that explores the roots of violence in the context of religious fanaticism. It would be wholly unfair to blame the Lafferty murders on the Mormon religion, whether mainstream or fundamentalist. And yet, but for the Lafferty's foray into Mormon fundamentalism, Brenda and Erica Lafferty would still be alive. And but for the mainstream Mormon practice of plural marriage in the 19th century, accompanied by the very real violent aspects of early Mormonism, violent polygamous cults would not exist as a part of fringe Mormonism. Regrettably, but truthfully, the roots of their crimes reach back to a time and place where top Mormon leaders condoned and even encouraged violence. I don't know whether the LDS Church should revive its darker past by admitting and repudiating it, or whether it should let this sleeping dog, or in this case, sleeping wolf, lie. I do know that in my lifetime, the ghosts of the past have risen to take the lives of probably a dozen people, if you add the LeBaron murders to the Lafferty murders, and I fear that with history's propensity to repeat itself, we have not seen the ghosts for the last time.
I think I better set the record straight right at the outset. As an independent fundamentalist Mormon, I am very much opposed, as Nadine said, to these young marriages, to planned marriages, to forced marriages, to minors when the husband is over 10 years older than she is. Being as a very optimistic person, I'm not going to dwell on a lot of the negative in the book. I'm admitting that it's there, and I will address some of those issues, but I have chosen to present some positive alternatives for part of my paper. So to begin with, once again, the squeaky wheel in our communities, both Mormon and fundamentalist, is getting the attention. But what's interesting in this book is that both of them are being put under scrutiny in the same book. Usually the fundamentalist Mormons are attacked by the Mormon Church or by somebody outside that, and then the Mormons might have their own set of scrutiny in some other source. But it's interesting to see it under the same title. As a longtime independent fundamentalist Mormon, I'm grateful for this opportunity to respond to John's book, but please realize I'm speaking from my own point of view, and probably that of several other Mormon fundamentalists, but certainly not in behalf of the fundamentalist Mormons in general, since they are so numerous and diverse. This diversity ranges from mild-mannered, non-aggressive believers who blend into the landscape, to women in pioneer attire living in secluded communities, to a few men in Levi's or death slacks justifying violence because of hearing divine voices or because of their interpretation of blood atonement. It has only been during the past 3 years that I have felt comfortable in publicly admitting my fundamentalist Mormon beliefs and lifestyle. In December of 2000, I helped to write and publish a book entitled Voices in Harmony, Contemporary Women Celebrate Plural Marriage. This is a compilation of about 100 testimonies and essays from plural wives who are happy in the principle. They've either lived it or are now living it and have a story that they wanted to tell. They did this anonymously, and to me, this is just kind of the opposite of Krakauer's book. He's presenting the violent and the negative, and we are trying to present the positive. We had heard so much negative. There were three authors. We had heard so much negative for so long that we felt like somehow some positive information had to get out, because how could we blame the media for telling about all the negative things if nobody gave them a chance to hear anything positive? So I'm here as an example of somebody that was absolutely very happy in this principle for many, many years. Maybe you can imagine my feelings then as I read Under the Banner of Heaven, which focuses once again on the negative and violent parts of the fundamentalist Mormon culture. Even though I can't say that I enjoyed reading Under the Banner of Heaven, I'm glad I read it because I have known most of the players he described as Mormon fundamentalists. Fortunately, the author does make an attempt to distinguish between the violent and the nonviolent players, but he has done a real disservice to both the LDS Church and to fundamentalist Mormons alike. And why is this? The first printing, there were 350,000 printed, and it's now in its third printing. It's number, as has been mentioned, it's number one on the New York bestsellers list. There are going to be a lot of people that this is the only book that they read on Mormons or fundamentalist Mormons, and they're going to come to an easy conclusion that, my gosh, there's more than their share of violence and eccentric people in those communities. And I think that's a shame, because there's so much good in both. Centering on the Dan and Ron Lafferty murders, John Krakauer brings into the fundamentalist Mormon picture Tom Green, the Kingstons, Colorado City, Brian David Mitchell, Lilla Behrens, Robert Crossfield, Kenyon Blackmore, John Bryant, and Alex Joseph, all claiming beliefs in some type of fundamental Mormonism. Most of these so-called extremists, however, were also connected with the LDS Church at one time. The majority of the fundamentalist Mormons don't want to claim any relationship with some of those I just listed above, any more than the LDS Church wants to claim Ted Bundy, Gary Gilmore, Brian David Mitchell, Gary Arthur Bishop, and Mark Hoffman. In any community, there's going to be a certain element of violence. So I hate to see one community segregated as having a lot of it in existence. Religious obsession sometimes leads to hearing voices or conversing. Conversely, hearing voices occasionally results in religious obsession. Krakauer accurately explains that, quote, the religious fanatic's perspective narrows until the last remnants of proportion are shed from his life. Common sense is no match for the voice of God. So he quotes other people as justifying their actions. Claiming to have heard, quote, the voice of God seems to be a common denominator of those religious fanatics mentioned in Under the Banner of Heaven. It is evident, however, that since they are so contradictory, all their claims can certainly not possibly come from the same divine source. How then can we determine which of these voices are really from God? Joseph Smith said that inspiration comes from three sources. Quote, the spirit of God, the spirit of man, and the spirit of the devil. If the message exalts the man and says how great and wonderful he is, chances are that message didn't come from God. Joseph Smith was very concerned about the source of revelation and discernment of spirits. In fact, in E. Hatton Cook, in their book Words of the Prophet Joseph Smith, Words of Joseph Smith, says, quote, there was no point upon which the prophet Joseph dwelt more than the discerning of spirits. The prophet insisted that true religion was one of individual participation in revelation from God, but that in their zeal, many would be deceived. End quote. It seems that many cases of faith-based violence could possibly have been avoided if the participants had possessed this gift of discernment. I have compiled the following 10 guidelines from the words of Joseph Smith, from the words of Alma, and from the Doctrine and Covenants to be used in determining whether or not a religious message came from a divine source. There are references for all these, and I'll just quickly go through them, but I can support them with references. There's 10 of them. One, you will feel peace and joy. You will not feel malice, hatred, strife, or evil. Your whole desire will be to do good and bring forth righteousness. You will desire to build up the kingdom of God. The message will not contradict a former revelation. You will not have previously revolted at anything that came from God. Any revealed principles will be eternal in nature. The message will be for your personal benefit and instruction. The message will enlarge your soul, enlighten your understanding, and be delicious. Your bosom will burn within you. However, Brigham Young did give a warning in this regard. He said, quote, when individuals are blessed with visions, revelations, and great manifestations, look out. The devil is nigh you, and you will be tempted in proportion to the visions, revelations, manifestations you have received. In other words, the greater the manifestation from God, the greater the possibility that the adversary will get equal time to tempt you. If Dan and Ron Lafferty had used these guidelines mentioned above in determining the source of their revelations, the outcome would undoubtedly have been very different. But according to Krakauer, Dan was instead greatly influenced by a publication printed in Nauvoo in 1842 called The Peacemaker, a portion of which is referred to as the little-known discourse. The entire book was probably never published, but the title page for the two-chapter extract lists Udney Hay Jacob as the author and Jay Smith as the printer. Over the years, some have speculated that Joseph Smith may have been the author, but this is not consistent with a statement by Joseph Smith himself, printed under the date of December 1, 1842, in the Times and Seasons. And I quote, there was a book printed in my office a short time since, written by Udney Hay Jacob, on marriage, and had I been apprised of it, I should not have printed it. Not that I'm opposed to any man enjoying his privileges, but I do not wish my name associated with the authors on such an unmeaning rigmarole of nonsense, folly, and trash. End quote. Udney Hay Jacob, born in 1781, was not a member of the LDS Church when he wrote this reference work. According to Norton, the eldest of his 9 children, he did not even believe in Mormonism and was true until a year later when he was baptized in 1843. Since Dan Lafferty was satisfied that Joseph Smith was the author of The Peacemaker, he began adapting its not-so-peaceful principles to regulate his household. And then I've gone into a few things which somewhat have been mentioned and how dictatorial he was to his family and curtailing their activities very unreasonably. So it appears that Dan was patterning his life after the advice of someone other than the prophet Joseph Smith. In his book, Krakauer incorrectly refers to all fundamental... Now I'll go into a couple of points where I think he was inaccurate. He inaccurately refers to all fundamentalist Mormons as FLDS. Those initials only refer to those from Colorado City, Hilldale area. He also states incorrectly that all fundamentalist Mormons are extremely critical of the LDS Church, which is certainly not the case with the hundreds of fundamentalists I know. They are very understanding. They go along with the LDS Church as far as they go. The author rather abruptly jumps around in discussing personalities. But one minute he's in the world of fundamentalism, then back to mainstream Mormonism, then fundamentalism, as Nadine pointed out. Being the eternal optimist that I am, I cannot present this paper without trying to balance the accounts of Krakauer's book with at least a few positive, nonviolent examples of strong faith and personal revelation. And in the interest of time, I won't have time. Let me just read one or two of them. In response to their personal revelation, several fundamentalist families from England left their native lands, homes, jobs, and extended families a few years ago to peacefully gather to Zion in order to mingle with those of similar beliefs to help a community. In response to her personal revelation, a new plural wife, quote, chose to follow this holy principle of plural marriage regardless of what the circumstances may be. I know that, plural, quote, she continues, I know that plural marriage is a true and everlasting principle ordained of God. The Holy Spirit bore witness to me that in an all-knowing perfect peace. And then I have several others, but Although you may not agree with the religious position taken by many fundamentalist Mormons, I present them to you to show how they responded in a peaceful manner rather than with violence. And just for the record, many more non-squeaky examples could be related. In conclusion, John Krakauer made some strong points with which I am in total agreement. And I've just got about 15 seconds more. quote, to whatever extent, this is John Krakauer speaking, to whatever extent the LDS religion moves beyond the most problematic facets of Joseph Smith's theology and succeeds at becoming less and less peculiar, fundamentalists are bound to pull more and more converts from the Mormon Church's own swelling ranks. I personally have witnessed and continue to witness such cases. I also agree with the author when he supported the statement by Michael Quinn, quote, the tragic reality is that there have been occasions when church leaders, teachers, and writers have not told the truth they knew about difficulties of the Mormon past, but have offered to the saints instead a mixture of platitudes, half-truths, omissions, and plausible denials. And also, I certainly agree with John Taylor's statement from which Krakauer took the title of his book, quote, when the government conflicts with heaven, we will be ranged under the banner of heaven. But I think there are peaceful, nonviolent ways of rallying under that banner. Thank you.
I have many mixed reactions to this book. I'm overwhelmed by the image of victimhood and persecutors. Complex that is very prominent in our culture today, and I'll say more about that in just a few moments. In many ways, this book is like what we say in psychiatry and psychology is a massive Rorschach. A Rorschach is where you ask an individual to begin to associate about the images and experiences they have. Unfortunately, I think the Rorschach is Krakauer's and not necessarily ours. He does what many apologists do. Pick and choose to string together a whole series of associations around a major image, a major story, the Lafferty story. And I think it does violence at many levels. In fact, it comes close to being what we see in paranoia, which I'll say something about when I talk about Ron Lafferty. And that is, when paranoia begins to emerge, we see what's called the erection of a paranoid pseudo-community. The individual or individuals begin to pick this person, that person, look at the common elements, forget the differences, string them together, and erect then a massive, singular, massive view about what reality is, usually a persecutory one, which we see really as a reflection in the book. Now, what this boils down to in many ways, as I look at it, out, that there's an extensive analysis and support for all those psychologists, psychiatrists who supported the viewpoint of the prosecution that Ron Lafferty was not mentally ill. And certainly there's an area of argument here forensically about some of this. I certainly don't want to pretend to know that I certainly have all the answers. He quoted me, and of course I felt there was mental illness. Interestingly, he didn't go on to go through all the arguments I presented. And let me just present a couple of things about the Lafferty family. I went through my file, which is about that big last night, on the Lafferty's, and I had a chance to pick out a few comments here. First of all, looking at this from a family systems point of view, the key here is the family system, the Lafferty's, a very, very disturbed system. 2 to 3 generations back, we have the history of violence and abuse. The father was extremely abusive. The mother was, of course, victimized. Again, I'd like to correct the thought here to see how this is all tied into the religious dimensions, polygamy and so forth. Certainly those elements were used by the Lafferty brothers in their story. As everyone uses their own religious or other cultural experiences to deal with their behavior. But the key element was the origin of the violence of the Lafferty's was in the family system. Ron Lafferty, who became the standard bearer for the father when he died 1 year before all this happened, became the standard bearer to carry on and solve this now almost insolvable regression in the family, acting out the violence that he had seen and participated in again and again. That's the origin of the violence. Yes, we have all covering of the religious issues. Of course that's there. But I think we need to make that point. Now let me just for a few brief moments give you a vignette of a few things that most people may not know about. In January 1984, this is several months before the murders took place, we have a letter from Ron Lafferty to his wife, Diana, admonishing her that a great event's going to happen, the church is going to be destroyed, many wild collective events. He then talked about how he and Diana had made a pre-existing covenant. And of course, what we see in the letter is the tremendous anguish he was going through of losing his wife. And I would say the bottom line of the psychology that we need to get in touch with here is the loss of his wife and what that did to him. Now, his revelations begin to grow. He talks about Satan being in control of her. He warns her that she's going to lose everything and be cast off. And in fact, he says to her, and by the way, this is after she now has left and divorced him, I will cast you off eternally if you continue to reject me. Well, she'd already rejected him. Then we have, in the context, February 1984, the removal revelation. Now, it's interesting. The removal revelation, I think, becomes, again, part of what I'm going to summarize as a paranoid delusional system. A displacement of the tremendous loss and anger toward Diana that he could not tolerate. He could not process. And so it gets displaced onto Brenda and others. And finally, what I want to really point out is the most, and I felt it was the most insightful view I had of Ron Lafferty, and that was his revelation concerning what happened to him and Diana in the pre-existence. He quoted first the famous Mosiah Hancock vision, which many of you are familiar with, and I won't go into that. That vision has a very different flavor than Ron Lafferty's. But in Ron Lafferty's revelation, number one, he is one of the six mighty and strong who casts out Satan and his angels. And lo and behold, who is Satan's spouse? Diana. But she gets one chance being cast off to come to earth and be chosen by that one who stood up for her, Ron. Now, I submit to you that this revelation has all the earmarks of a delusional system, far beyond anything that rationally or spiritually any Mormon of any ilk would entertain. And I can say more about that if people want to challenge that. And to me, since I have a chance to have the audience at this point, and Krakauer didn't give me the chance to express my views on this, he wanted to back the views of the other investigators. Most of the other investigators who justified Ron not being mentally ill were based on what I consider superficial explanations going into the content of various religious ideas. Certainly they're important, but it is the function of the idea and the imagery and the story and the revelation. It's the function and how they work in the individual's mind and actions that determine whether it's delusional or just an extreme thought. I submit to you that these were delusional ideas. This was a delusional train of thinking. Well, I think I've said enough about that. There may be more people would like to talk about. The same with Dan Lafferty and the Nephi story of killing, justifying killing, killing because of Nephi and the Laban story. Compare those stories. They're totally different. How does Brenda Lafferty and Erica Lafferty have to do with anything significant if you want to take the literal story of Nephi and Laban? A totally different context. Again, you have to analyze the context of what's happening before you can put together these ideas. Certainly, I think that both of them were on that bent. Finally, then, I would like to summarize by saying that I think this book is essentially a sad commentary on the regression we in this culture are in. I think we feel so helpless over September 11th attacks, the issues of Iraq, the Muslim religion. I think that we feel helpless, and it appeals to a chord here so that we can triangulate out somebody. We're helpless. We're dealing with this unknown out there, the Muslim religions, the Arab world that we're so upset about. We've got to triangulate out, and the victims are basically what we want to pick on here. Now, of course, I'm not denying that we have many serious problems in Mormonism. Not at all. We've heard a lot about that today. But I think that this book is basically a regression. I don't think it's going to help us solve these problems that we all need to solve. To me, I think that And then in the beginning of the book, Krakow gives himself away. He wants to see the roots of the Lafferty violence. I don't think he sees them at all. I think he has an overlay, a connection to so many things that are so far out, it doesn't make sense. When someone said in the New York Times, it doesn't hang together, that's the bottom line, is what I see. As I say, it's got almost the flavor of a paranoid pseudo-community, stringing this together, that together. And again, I would emphasize, when all of us agreed when we saw the Laffertys, that the main issues were these issues of control, violence, constitutionalism. The polygamy issues came in very secondarily. Sure, they were there. And yet, look how that's been strung into all the other dimensions of the story. Again, I think a misreading and a basically sensationalism that really doesn't deserve the kind of attention that that has been given. But it has struck a chord. It has struck a chord in all of us. And I think the chord that's there is we feel helpless. We feel helpless against that other. And so what happens then? The automatic triangle. We have to find the scapegoat. And here it is, you see. And that's how I think it's evolved. And so I think we need to have a more balanced view. We've heard some wonderful balanced comments here today. Interestingly, Anne has given us some very interesting, what I would like to say is religious, spiritual approaches to dealing with delusional activity, a false belief that goes to the extremes. When you think of the outcome, really, does a revelation in the context of these experiences speak to something spiritual? I can't imagine any Mormon taking that stance. And finally, I think it's the duty of all religions, all groups in all the world, to take responsibility to say, hey, wait a minute, here's our religious life. We disown this when it comes into the tragedy of individuals such as the Laffertys. I think there are many religions that have not done that. I'm wondering if the Muslim religions have done enough of that, have disowned some of the violence that's sponsored. Well, that's another question. But let me say this. In my own sense of feeling, though, I have a great deal of compassion and feeling for Ron, less for Dan Lafferty. I knew him less. I think he certainly was more deliberate in what he did. And I can't really comment a lot about all that I would say about his mental state. Ron, I can say, this man had an organic illness. He tried to hang himself. By the time he was tried the second time, I don't see how anybody could not see anything but the organic brain syndrome, the paranoia, the delusional activity that went on, that I think then would bring in what every culture brings in, and that is the admission that we can basically, we have to accommodate for those people who become mentally ill and give some understanding of them and protection of the society, as well as to try to help them get back to where they go. And that's my feeling about him. Thank you very much.
Nadine would like to say a couple of words about the trial.
I just wanted to maybe clarify something that Jess was just talking about. He uses the term mental illness in talking about Ron Lafferty, which is the proper term from his discipline of psychiatry. The law uses the term insanity, and there's a legal definition of insanity. I think we would not argue that, or nobody would argue that Ron Lafferty, who had this delusional revelation, wasn't mentally ill. But the legal definition of insanity has to do with whether the person knows that objectively these acts are right or wrong, and whether they understand the nature of their acts. And so, for instance, earlier this year, or maybe it was last year, but fairly recently, the woman in Texas, I forget her name, who drowned her five children, I'm sure that none of us would argue that she is not mentally ill. But she was convicted of murder because she knew she was killing her children. And she knew that what she was doing was wrong according to society standards. And so I think that's why we get Ron Lafferty determined by the court not to be insane, even though he is mentally ill. And I just wanted to make that distinction.
Thank you. One of the questions that arises, as I mentioned before, is the extent to which Krakauer is accurate in his description of the origin of violence. Could one say, for example, that the seeds of the current conflict in the Middle East lie in the Quran and in the Old Testament, and do the seeds of the Crusades lie in the New Testament? Well, perhaps they do, but as we know from Jesus' parable of the sower of the seeds, different things happen to seeds. It seems to me that one of the problems that Krakauer's book identifies is the ambivalence that Mormon culture has had to its past, and certainly the ambivalence it has had towards polygamy, and the inability to separate itself either organizationally or emotionally or spiritually from that past perhaps makes his book a little bit more troublesome for those of us who are part of the Mormon community. I personally didn't recognize the church I grew up in Krakauer's book. On the other hand, I have to say that probably for most Mormons, contemporary Mormons, much of what they read in there, which is accurate, will be a surprise to them. And it certainly will come as a shock to those who see the church, those outside the church who see us in the more perhaps sanitized way in which we present ourselves to the world. Anyway, I'd like to take the remaining time we have for questions. I would like for no one to give another review of the book, and for no one to make a statement about the book. I would like for, if you have a question, to address it to the panel. But before we do that, I'd like to know whether or not any of the other panel members have anything they would like to say before we entertain questions. Jess has a word.
Comment on Nadine's comment about insanity. There are two forms here. There's insanity where one is totally insane versus not. Then there are other standards in terms of diminished capacity. And certainly I would argue that there was diminished capacity in Ron Lafferty's situation, which makes a whole world of difference in terms of punishment.
Oh, okay. Well, we have an attorney here who wants the last word.
Well, it's not really even so much as a last word, but it just as a matter of how the law has developed over the past 20 or so years, there used to be concepts of diminished capacity, and then after the Twinkie defense in San Francisco where Harvey Milk killed the mayor, California at least, and I think many other states followed suit, by closing that diminished capacity defense. And I really don't know what the law was in Utah in 1984 when these murders took place, but I do know that the trend around the country has been to close to make it harder to prove insanity, so we're not letting people off. Now, I'm not going to say whether that is good or bad. I think that's something that society needs to discuss, and Jess may be right that we need to take into consideration to a greater extent people's diminished capacity and people's insanity and people's delusions. But just from a legal standpoint, there may not have been a legal defense of diminished capacity, or there may have been at that time, and I just don't know. Oh, and could I ask Ann a question?
Sure.
Have you considered in the wake of this, all of the publicity about this book, going on a book tour to present the other side of polygamy?
Yeah, would you like to sponsor that?
If, in order to save time, if those of you who have questions would come down to the front so you can step up here right away. I was going to, if you have questions, you can address them to me and I'll try and repeat them. If you want to ask them, come here. One of the objections that I did have, as I mentioned earlier, is when Krakauer talks about Joseph Smith and says, because that rapture was so wholly consuming and felt so good to him. Well, how does he know that it felt good to him? Another point, he says, the Lord, it seemed to him, a surely intended man to know the love of more than one wife. It's the same kind of problem I have with Brody, is when she starts imagining or telling us what Joseph Smith thought or imagined or felt, and that's a dangerous kind of way to write history. Okay, questions? Anyone have a specific question that they would like to address to a member of the panel? Yes, please.
Thank you.
I've never been involved in the publication of a book, and so I do not know the process of editing and verification that goes on. I currently am reading a book called The Poetess and the Murderer. Some of you know it, I would guess. It's about Mark Hoffman's forgery of a poem of Emily Dickinson. I am appalled at what he presents about the Mormon Church, including details about the temple ceremony that are very, very incorrect. And I shot off a note, a card to Penguin Putnam saying, is there no process for verification? Can anybody get printed anything they want? And there we are, hanging out to the rest of the world with these, what to us are sacred rituals presented in a very bizarre, inaccurate way. And I want to know, do we have no protection over this? Do we just assume that everything that is written is correct, or should I start assuming that everything is, that's published is not correct?
The publisher has no responsibility. It's the accuracy of a book. It's the author's responsibility. By writing the publisher, the author will eventually get the message, probably, but you can't blame Putnam, Penguin, whoever it is that published the book. I've self-published books for 35 years, and we assume all responsibility for its accuracy, not the printer or the publisher.
It's an interesting question that you ask. It raises a question about the validity of any book and who checks it out. I was surprised, as probably many of you are, as we've been studying the lives of the teachings of the prophets in our priesthood and Relief Society meetings, to find that in these textbooks there's mention of only one wife of Brigham Young and John Taylor, and I don't know who is supposed to have checked the details on that. Things do slip through, and we know that there are perfect texts only in heaven. Additional questions? Yes, please come and address the question here.
I don't know whether it was something that I read in a review or whether it was actually in the book itself, but it strikes me that what's giving this book a lot of its relevance right now is it's trying to make the point that We're entering a world where secularism and fundamentalism are going to clash in ever increasing ways. And you kind of talk about whether the book's important to a Mormon scholarly perspective, I think, is not what is causing it to sell so many copies. It's rather how it's predicting this world. Do you have any comment or thoughts as to how effective it is in doing that?
This is a very relevant comment. I think it does focus on that very issue of fundamentalism versus secularism and change. And again, one of the problems with fundamentalism all over the world is its resistance, its rigidity in terms of new ideas. And that's one of the problems. And I think that's it. And again, I think here we see, as I mentioned earlier, a kind of a triangulation going on. Again, I don't want to deny the fact that we have many problems that have been discussed here, but I think that in some ways this book does disservice to these kind of issues that you raise between fundamentalist view versus a more secular or more liberal view. And that is, it tends to triangulate out, find something far worse or far more horrible than what we're facing, and thus give you some relief.
We need to close. I would recommend for your reading, if you haven't already read it, Karen Armstrong's book on fundamentalism in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Let me close with just a little story, a very brief one. In my ward, the missionaries often come to me to ask me about things like this. And last week, three sweet young missionaries came and said, how do we handle this book? And what can we do? Because people are asking us about it, and missionaries don't know a lot about our history. And so I had a nice chat with them about the importance of them being honest about the things that are accurate here, being reflective about the things in their own experience. And then I close by saying this. This is what you should do. You should say to the people that you talk to, you should read the last paragraph in Krakauer's book, in which he says, and I remain in the dark about our purpose here and the meaning of eternity. I have nevertheless arrived at an understanding of a few more modest truths. Most of us fear death. Most of us yearn to comprehend how we got here and why, which is to say, most of us ache to know the love of our Creator. And we will no doubt feel that ache, most of us, for as long as we happen to be alive. And I said, you can say to them, Krakauer aches to feel the love of the Creator. Let us show you how you can feel it. Thank you very much.